AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
This month, we welcome veteran author, expert in the esoteric, and founder of House Khefuru, Michelle Belanger, author of The Little Book of Wicked Spells, Binding and Retribution Magic, from Hadean Press's Guides to the Underworld series. Michelle and I discuss her experiences in adapting and working the ancient magic of Mesopotamia and Hellenic Greece into rites suitable for the modern period, specifically focusing on the nature of binding and cursing. We explore the homilies of practice which echo through history, magic and materia, the nature of rage, desperation and rebellion, and the universal desire for a rebalancing of the scales of justice. I am your host, Matt Hadfield, and it is with great pleasure that I introduce Michelle Belanger to the Hadean Press podcast. Michelle, welcome to the podcast. We are here today to talk about your little book of wicked spells, but before we get into all that, could you please tell us about yourself and what was it that got you into magic and the occult?
Oh, I was an early bloomer when it came to weird stuff. I was raised in a family where psychic abilities were accepted as fairly normal, and I had a lot of experiences as an early young kid. And my way of understanding those was not to simply let things happen to me. I wanted to read books and find out what other people believed. And of course, I also grew up with a great love of horror. And these two things sort of converged in reading Edgar Allan Poe and the Scottish play perilously young. And I wanted to see what was real among these things. Like the mythology and the stories fascinated me, and I wanted more. I wanted to know what was really behind it. And that academic quest steered the course of my life, honestly. When I ended up, I was a National Merit Scholar. I ended up at a nice Jesuit college. I settled. But you learn really good magic from the Jesuits, as it turns out. The Catholics are pretty big on ritual. My undergrad work was in comparative religious studies with a concentration on psychology of religion. So I've always been like really motivated to understand like not only what is the history of this, what's the sociological impact of this, what are the beliefs around it, but also why do people do these things? Like, why is this belief? Why are these practices so important? How have they shaped us as people and as societies?
And was there any particular moment that really stands out to you?
I have a very specific one. And again, I was very precocious. So this was in elementary school. I was under the age of 10. I know it was partly inspired by having watched, of all things, a Star Trek original series episode where there was this weird alien masquerading as an angel, and there was this sort of cult of little children who would chant a song to summon him. And I loved that idea of mixing poetry and song for a summoning. And I was out on the playground, and a wind was blowing up, and I wanted to have recess indoors, not very good outside. And I decided to try to summon a wind in a storm. And I remember word for word what I was chanting. Thunder, lightning, wind, and rain, blow the clouds in, storm again. Thunder, lightning, wind, and hail, lightning, flash, and thunder, wail. And I said that over and over and over again. And the wind is kicking up. And the funniest thing at the time was one of the teachers who was the recess minder, the only one, like she just suddenly her head kind of went on a swivel. She stared right at me and was like, "Stop that." And I'm like, I think I just got caught doing something that I really shouldn't be doing. I want to do it again.
That's wonderful. That's really wonderful. Lovely. I think weather phenomena seems to be a very common trope amongst several of my guests.
It's exciting, and like you get, or at least it certainly seems like you get like an immediate reaction. You're calling something up, and the wind rises, and you can see and feel. If you stop, and it just dies down, you've got some feedback of, is what I'm doing having an impact on the world around my immediate sphere of influence.
And was that you just recited from the Scottish play? Is that from Macbeth?
I made that up off the top of my head, but you have to understand, I had read the Scottish play and I became obsessed with the witch's dance. I memorized that and would like reenact it and just have a grand old time trying to figure out what half of the words were. This is what happens when you have an autodidact who is an only child and is just sort of left alone in a house with a lot of old books.
We've never had someone on the show who has a very specific focus on curse work and binding, but regardless of our morals and our modern sensibilities, it is an area of historical magic which is absolutely worth our time in discussing for a whole variety of different reasons. But let's start with you personally, though. You have clearly studied the Greek magical papyri and many other historical sources of this form of magic. What was it that inspired you to put this little book of modern malefic magic together?
Well, the little book of wicked spells came about because I was angry, infuriated, honestly, at like what I was seeing happen in my country in the US, but also on a broader scale. And since I was tiny, one of the things that I would do if I when I see something in the world that I need to change and I do not have the tools to physically impact that. I'm 9 or 10 and railing at the fact that, there's this summit about nuclear proliferation and there's nothing I can do about that. I would write a saucy little song. I would write a ditty. I would write satirical poetry. But as you saw, like some of my earliest magic was also doggerel verse, like that idea of pairing words and rhythm, making it easier to remember. And so a lot of my earliest stuff, like my personal practice, was marrying word, poem, language, song, and rage at something that I needed to change in the world. A lot of the spells that are in the little book of wicked spells started off on Twitter and on Blue Sky as like things that I would just shout to the world to try to like put out and manifest. And I realized about halfway through that, leading into the total morass of just this strange descent into autocracy, that probably more than just me needed them.
So I've had the pleasure of reading them, and they have, I think, many of the same sort of patterns and same sort of virtues as many of the spells that we find, for instance, in the PGM. Do you have any specific PGM curses that you are particularly fond of that maybe have helped inspire you in this work?
In a lot of ways, it was the broad strokes, because not only in the Greek and Roman magical papyri, but also in Sumerian and Babylonian, like the Maklu texts, you have similar concepts of how to bind and control, or like how to find a way to limit the power of something that has an unfair advantage over you. So waxen images and literally nailing things down, binding things with string, tying things in knots. All of these things are meant to limit the power of something that you are otherwise physically powerless against. And that unequal power dynamic is really, to me, what makes this at best gray magic as opposed to black magic. It's not, it's a retributive, it's justice magic. This is the desperate cry of the marginalized to find some way to affect a change in a world that is stacked against them. That said, most of the bold divinations, I would say probably the first text that I was introduced to from the whole Greek and Roman magical papyri was actually Hellenic Coptic. It's the Leyden Papyrus. I had an old copy translated by A.E. Wallace Budge for all of his good and bad qualities. And the vessel divinations like really grabbed me. This idea of, first of all, they're a two-part process. You have the operator, and then you have usually a young boy. It's implied that he's young enough that he's pure, probably virginal. And that person is used as a medium, as a vessel. And you stand over and speak down into his head after all of the operations and all the materia have been gathered. But the bowl of water is used both as a scrying vessel, but also as the circle of summoning. So that the liminal, the shifting quality of the water, the mirror-like surface with a little bit of oil drizzled over the top, the spirits are called up through that water. The water is turned into a gate that is circumscribed by the edges of the vessel. And there's multiple variations of it, but every one of them like just really, really grabbed me. And you see it, and I know that's going to be something you'll ask about later, but you see that reversed for one of the spells to, instead of summon something up, to drown it in that water.
Yeah, so I think it's really important to highlight here that the content of your pamphlet is, while on the surface they appear to be curses, they're in fact, as you put it just then, it's more of a form of defense using this sort of technology. So I thought it was really fascinating. It's really interesting. And I'm really keen to continue digging into it with you. So, for instance, why do you think it's so important to adapt old spells, such as we found in the Greek magical papyri, into a new modern iteration?
The roots of magic are incredibly old. And there's a universality to certain activities. The words that we use, the gods that we pray to, the powers we invoke will change based on time and culture. But the actions are very human. Again, binding something, breaking something, finding a way to making a graven image, making an effigy, making something that represents a person or a being that you need, you perceive a need to have power over or an ability to strike out at, and then wrecking it, destroying it, melting it, allowing their power to run like wax, allowing it to melt like salt. There's just something incredibly visceral about that. And it also appeals to the psychology side of my studies, because not only is this magic, this is also therapeutically healing. Like if you are in a position where someone has power over you and you have nothing else you can do about it and you are in despair, at the very least, you can make this thing and take all of that fury out, channel it, and harness the power of that into a magical working to try to bring the justice, to bring the release that you need into the world.
So how would you then define a curse, and what distinguishes a curse from a binding?
I personally would make a difference between a binding and a curse. A curse is more aggressive, an act of reaching out to a target person, place, thing in order to do something malefic to it. It is active, it is aggressive, it can be predatory, and more traditionally evil, depending on what your purpose is and why you are lashing out. For me, a binding is more a defensive reaction. You are trying to take the power of something and limit it. Now, obviously, that can be used aggressively, that can be used in a way that is, well, first of all, it's going to be non-consensual, and in a lot of the older things, what you see is someone who is in a position where they don't have any other recourse, so that they will go to someone to do to make a lead curse tablet. There was a whole cottage industry of people who were educated in how to write out the curses. They had several of them that were just like kind of pat, just insert names here, roll it up on your little lead curse tablet, nail it shut, drop it down a well. But so many of the ones are someone who is seeking the return of stuff that have been stolen from them. They're looking to win a court case. Somebody has harmed them or is stalking them, and they want that person to pay. They want that person to stop. They want there to be some limit on their power. And again, magic is so often the recourse of the marginalized because they have nothing but a subversive reaction, because society has been built in such a way that they don't have recourse to the courts. They don't have the same level of support and infrastructure.
And that sense of powerlessness, it continues all the way through from the ancient world all the way up till the early modern period, especially when it's concerning women.
Certainly that, and also one of my favorite 20th century era workings, or at least a proposed working, the poet W.B. Yeats, in his letters, wanted to work with Maud Gonne. He wanted to do much more than work with Maud Gonne, but one of the things he proposed to her was to go to the sacred sites and try to basically resurrect the spirit of Ireland, like create the egregore in order to throw off English rule. And this idea of they'd tried everything else, and you know, he was very much involved in the revolutionary stuff at that time, and he also felt that fighting and bloodshed and war was only going to get you so far. Why not go to the source? Why not try to use magic to accomplish what hundreds of years had not managed to accomplish? And so someone who is under the yoke of a power that they don't necessarily have the ability to overthrow at the time, magic is an easy recourse.
That's an excellent example. Thank you. You mentioned the lead tablets being used. So in the introduction to your pamphlet, you mentioned the use of the catodesmoi, or what we, I think, we more usually called defixiones, the lead tablets. Could you explain something of their nature and their use in the ancient world, specifically in regard to the underworld, chthonic spirits, the psychopomps?
Well, we have so many of them in the historic record because once they were made, they were dropped down wells or buried or put in tombs, because it wasn't enough to write out this request. So a curse tablet is usually a small, thin lead tablet that has a curse or a binding or a request upon it. But it's not the request that you would make to the regular gods. It is the request you would make to dark powers, to the Furies, to Hades, to Persephone, to, in some cases, a whole litany of darker spirits that pretty much they would name every single one that they could possibly hope might hear it. Which I, sometimes, honestly, it's so instructive, the melting pot that these come from, because you will see a Agatha daemon named next to Adonai, and they just sort of like throw everybody in the pot. So that is then rolled up, often crimped or nailed shut, and then conveyed to a power that should be able to then carry it out. In a lot of cases, the person who has gone to someone to create this this curse or this binding for them, that person doesn't think that they have the power to do it. They are seeking an expert who then conveys it like a polite letter to the underworld of, dear so-and-so, could you please go send half a dozen Lemures after this fellow because he is really bothering Octavia, and Octavia just needs to be able to sleep in peace without him peeping through her windows. Please, thank you, okay, bye. And that makes it sound silly and everything, but like this was a whole job description. And there are hundreds, if not thousands, of these that really do tell the story of who was disenfranchised at the time, who needed or felt that they needed this service, and what did they seek the service for. Now, conveying a curse, a binding, or a retribution style spell to an underworld force is very old. There's a black dog exorcism that is in Henry Frederick Lutz has some translations of Sumerian Babylonian curses and spells. They're related to the Maklu text. Not all of them are Maklu though. And this particular one involves killing a black dog. Let's not be shy. Like, a lot of this stuff is much darker than what we would normally do. But it's specifically a black dog and a dog. A dog is an animal that was seen as eating the dead, which means he's a psychopomp. There's almost all of the animals that people observed in the natural world that they identified as psychopomps had something to do with corpses. They would eat those corpses and were seen as conveying the corpses to the other world. So this is automatically a good messenger. The color black has marked him as that sort of being. And so you basically make a ghost and send the ghost off to convey the message to have the spirits that are harrowing someone to lay off, please. It's a little bit less bloody and hands-on to simply drop down a well or bury it in somebody's tomb and hope that the spirit of the deceased will then convey the message to the powers that were thought to hold sway over these requests.
And so I think what you're getting at is that the stereotypical perspective of somebody throwing a curse isn't necessarily that they were just being malicious. It's that they're in a state of desperation.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are people who are malicious. So we probably all know at least one person who would maliciously do stuff like that. But the industry of curses and just what has come down to us in terms of primary materials, more often than not, it's someone who wants something to change in their life that they don't perceive that they have power to change themselves. And, you know, there's plenty of love spells and things where someone is trying to compel someone. They read like some of the nastiest stalker stuff you could imagine, like, and you see a lot of that in medieval magic as well. But alongside that, you see so many instances of people who just had something bad happen to them and they needed justice. They needed freedom. They needed someone who had power over them, whether it was the state, whether it was a person in their life, whether it was a force of nature, to be bound and limited so that they could live their life more freely.
So let's talk a little bit about the material aspect of cursing outside of just specific lead tablets. So are there any specific types of materia or sympathetic actions, perhaps, or patterns of speech which echo through time? And what other magic and materia are common in this type of magic? For instance, how can we make the use of, say, grave dirt or specific types of plants, herbs, or stones?
Nails are something that you find pretty widely used to nail things down, to fix them, defecciones, it's right in the name, to nail something shut, to drive it into the ground, and to symbolically nail a thing down. So nails are very common binding instruments. The lead in the lead tablet was associated with Saturn, of course, and the underworld. And so it wasn't by mistake that it was lead. And it wasn't just because it was cheaply available. I mean, goodness, the Romans used lead as a seasoning, for God's sake.
I didn't know that.
there was a whole thing of lead was, the rich people could afford better pots that had lead in them. The lead conveyed a particular flavor to the food that folks who couldn't afford lead pots would sprinkle lead on their food to get the flavor that the richer people had, which is a horrifying prospect now that we know about lead and lead poisoning. Yes. I digress. Also, sorry, my brain is a great big sponge for random bits of information. Knots, tying things in knots. It should be noted that a lot of these things are things that are easily available to someone who does not have a lot of money, and might not have access to a lot of other things. Magic, although I think that this can be an overly simplified way of looking at it, magic is usually seen as the recourse of people who are working outside of the social norms. So they're not going to the temple and praying. And they are, for some reason, disenfranchised from that more formal and more acceptable structure. And they are not donating to the temples. They might not have lots of gold to buy very, very expensive incense. So they're using what they have on hand. That said, there's a lot of the older stuff. Animals are a part of some of the materia, especially incenses. If you read the Leyden Papyrus, everything from drowning a scarab in the milk of a black cow is one, and pounding, oh goodness. The worst one, honestly, is, and I hope this is a mistranslation, is crocodile dung and pounding it and then anointing your member for virility. not a curse per se, but you're going to be paying for that if you attempt to recreate it.
We often have to have disclaimers on this podcast where I say, please do not try this at home.
Yeah, no, there's several that are just horrifying. Catch a bat, pluck out its eyes, stick its eyes on something else. Like some of them are really, really awful. And one of the choices that I was making with the Little Book of Wicked Spells was, what are things that we have on hand easily? What are things that have been used across the millennia that still speak to us, that have utility, that carry across? We might no longer, thankfully, understand why it was important to take specifically a scarab and specifically the milk of a black cow, drown it, and use the effluvia from that death to power the spell. But we can definitely see the purpose of a knot. We can definitely see the utility of a nail to nail something down, to pierce it. Incenses are used, but they vary based on culture and access, and again, are often the realm of the deities and more traditional religious usages. That's not to say that aloes wood or mace or other things don't appear in some of these, where you anoint your eyes to open yourself up to stuff. I think pounded myrrh with duck fat is one of the ones that sticks out in my mind from one of the Leyden Papyrus spells. And you'll see that again and again, or pieces of animals, tongues, feathers, but things that from an agrarian society where it was much more common to hunt, to kill your own food, that you would have these things on hand, that it isn't unusual to go out and just grab a goose, pluck it, and use parts of it, and then make use of that to additionally power spells. These days, that's not something that we do.
We forget in the modern day that when we're reading these documents, these people lived in a completely different world and a completely different heuristic of the way that the world functioned. And so if we read, you know, all these esoteric and strange ingredients for us, but for people back when these texts were written, they would have been the most common, usually the most common or easily accessible items. If they were written in code or something, because sometimes you have no idea what they're talking about.
Like I said, the crocodile dung, I really hope that that is a mistranslation. I know some of the plant ingredients, like they're either, they can be very difficult to track down because we don't always know what they were talking about. We have five different academics who each have six different interpretations of what that one specific thing is supposed to be. And in some cases, they are extinct. They are not around anymore, and we cannot accurately identify them.
Which is why it's, I think it's so important, like for texts like yours, that take these blueprints, these patterns that we can see in the historical record, and then reapplies it to the modern day. And I think that's really, really important. And that's really the crux of why I wanted to talk to you about all of these things today. I would love to just mention that there is a specific spell that utilizes an apple in your text. And from what I understand throughout the medieval grimoire tradition is that apples are almost exclusively used for coercive erotic love spells. And you have inverted that trope and used it to divide people from a toxic relationship. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, I loved taking that one and flipping it on its head. Apples throughout multiple cultures are used either in divination for identifying who you're going to marry. You cut the apple peel and toss it and you'll see their initials spelled out, all the way back to apples being used to find ways to force someone to love you. And let's not forget the Greek myth of tossing apples and choosing people, and goodness, Eris causing a little bit of a ruckus with that.
Callisto, right? To the forest.
Yeah. But what I wanted to do was, with a lot of the spells, I'm very consciously harnessing the wealth of associations we have with common objects, with items, the sort of stories that have imbued and come down to us from those myths, from those practices that still hit us somewhere. And with an apple, I wanted something that people could easily get their hands on. I wanted something that people could eat, that the majority of people would probably not have an adverse reaction or an ethical conundrum in consuming this. It's just an apple. I wanted to take the idea of an apple as something connected with the goddess of love and turn it into something that helps us find self-love and heal from something that has tainted love for us. Cutting it in half, like viscerally, that dismemberment, and throwing away, refusing and destroying, letting the elements take half of it, upon which you have, instead of doing a divination to let the apple rind spell out the name or the initials of your potential lover, you carve it in yourself. You are taking control. And that is another part of that subversion. It's not something that is being done for you. You are the one making the determination whose name goes on what side. And then you do this visceral act, cut it in half, get rid of half of it, and then eat the part that has you to take you back. I actually ran that ritual at a convention. I've done it a couple of times, and it is... it's got some power to it, and it's really fun to watch people. Like, I've got a really good meat cleaver and a very nice, at this point, quite pitted board. And you know, the first couple of people are a little timid and they'll just sort of like cut it and do it. By the time we're done and it's really started rolling, like people walk up and they're just like whack. Two pieces of apple just cascade over. They reclaim theirs and off goes the one that we need to let go of.
That sounds incredibly cathartic.
Magic for me is also catharsis. And I think harnessing that, recognizing that there is a psychological aspect to magic and that does not invalidate the power. In fact, it's part of its power. And finding ways to twine that consciously with all of these old traditional ways of doing magic and moving it into our 20th and 21st century understanding of ourselves and how we contextualize our world.
Moving on to the next question, and I suppose we could consider this part of what you were just saying, like recontextualizing things. But to what degree do you find astrology useful in this form of magic, in this specific kind of cursing and binding? For instance, do you pay attention to the positions of Mars and Saturn when you cast a curse?
Sometimes, yes. And sometimes it's not always convenient to wait. And I do it case by case. When we have something like a big eclipse, different cultures have different attitudes on what you should or shouldn't be doing on eclipses. And to go back to like Sumerian, Babylonian stuff, like some of their really intense rituals are about trying to basically it's apotropaic against the negativity of eclipses. But in the same way that I like to harness something and turn it on its head, I like this like looming sense of doom and disaster. And why not do that kind of work and harness it and ride that wave if you can?
And we had a lunar eclipse yesterday, didn't we?
We did in fact. One of my batches of Keefe, I started on a lunar eclipse shortly after the George Floyd stuff as a whole invocation of change and catharsis and breaking things down and finding a way out of the dark. Broadly, though, I will say that I personally don't resonate really well with astrology. And so I'm married to the grandchild of Dr. Vera Rubin, who is the astronomer who, actually, physicist, astronomer, she is the mother of dark matter. And my wife's mother was also an astrophysicist. So if I get too much into astrology, I get a little bit of side eye.
That's awesome. But why not both?
Well, and the funny thing is her mother was definitely why not both. Her mother, Dr. Judith Young, as much as she was an astrophysicist, she was also an archaeoastronomer, and she built a sun wheel at the University of Massachusetts, and absolutely had her own magical practice that went hand in hand with her fascination for the motions of the heavens, inheriting a lot of her work from frankly difficult to interpret photographs from massive observatory telescopes, like these photographs of spiral arm galaxies that are so distant, they're practically unreal. They're magic themselves. But then also her writings about her dream work and her journeying and her sort of conversation with the universe. She was a really good mix of science and mysticism and a pretty good exemplar to hold up.
Previously, you mentioned that we were discussing that magic, well, curse work often comes from a state of desperation. But in your pamphlet, you also write that magic is rebellion. And I've written something very similar myself in the past, that there is always a revolution in hell. When you say magic is rebellion, what is it exactly that you mean?
It is the space you occupy when society and structure and the dominant paradigm does not allow for you to exist in whatever form and shape you are, your magic, your words, your identity. It's not only the last resort of the desperate. It is a primal cry to the universe for the balancing of the scales of justice, for it is a demand that we are all allowed a place, that we should be afforded not the luxury, but the right and the freedom to exist as we are in this space. And magic allows us to not just shriek to the heavens, but again, in the spirit of W.B. Yeats, who absolutely paired his magical workings with real life work to try to forward the Irish cause. He paired it with magic because every revolution is a thought first. And magic is in that spark. That's our Promethean flame.
I love that. That's wonderful. So how can we today innovate with curse work to help our communities?
When I wrote Little Book of Wicked Spells, like one of the things I wanted to be clear on is it's not meant to be a replacement for doing work that is like physical and tangible in your world. That said, words inspire. Seeing that there is a chance, a way to push back, and having that passed along so that you have that first imaginal spark that we can imagine the possibility of a world that is different. And here is a spell that describes that shape, that calls it into being, that summons it like a spirit from the other world. And let's pass that from person to person to person while we also do the other work of living and existing and supporting one another and finding a way through.
You, I think you used the phrase decisive action.
Yes. Now, my French ancestors probably have some very clear ideas of exactly what that would look like. And I come from a legacy. My grandfather fought in World War II, but whatever he was doing behind enemy lines in France before D-Day to prepare the way. And the extent of it he took to his grave, but I know that it was wet work, to put it bluntly. And he was also someone who practiced magic and paired all of those things. Like the physical stuff he was doing, he also made sure that there was intent and will. My mom was a hippie who got shot at Kent State, you know, protesting. And in her case, her magic was her art and her music. Definitely something that like is part of my own legacy, and composing songs and making art that again demonstrate that spark of what you want the world to look like. So there's a creative aspect, there's a communal aspect, but also magic should not be the excuse to continue to sit on your butt and do nothing. And that's the one danger that I felt. It was actually one of the few things that made me hesitate to release the book at first. Not that there were curses in there, not that there were bindings in there, not that it is calling back to a potentially violent past, but that some people may see that and get enough of a release that they then just don't go out and protest, that they don't go out and try to make an actual substantial change in their community. Whatever that might look like we all have different levels of ability and access and privilege, and we have different roles when it comes to rebellion and activism, and understanding that for one person, being the safe home base that everybody can come back to I forget what pamphlet I read it in, but it's basically, you make soup. That's actually how you support the rebellion. You are the person who makes soup because everybody needs to eat and everybody needs a point to come back and be quiet and recharge. And I think that's another thing to think about in times like this that are so tumultuous, that there are very active, potentially aggressive actions that can and should be taken. And after that, there are also nurturing actions. There are also supportive actions. And if we don't have a balance of both of them, whatever we're doing will fail. And if we don't have a balance of doing something like magic to bring it about in the imaginal world, to speak it into being, and balance that with some sort of physical action, whether it's calling your senators for whatever good that's going to do. I'm feeling a little bit, a whole lot negative about that, because I think we may be at the point in the United States of taking to the streets is about the only option left to us in terms of other things that we can do.
You mentioned making soup and having a home base, and that's also an incredibly vital aspect of this entire process. So, for instance, how could one work apotropaea into this balance system? So we have specific methods that we can use in an aggressive sense, but we also need to protect ourselves. And perhaps people in our audience might worry about any kind of negative consequences to themselves if they perform a curse act. So what would you say to those people?
My first assessment for, is this just? Is this right? Because for me, the line between this will probably rebound on me is I'm doing it selfishly for a petty reason, only for myself, as opposed to there is a wrong that must be redressed. There is some, actually the line for me is, and God, one of the reasons I put this together and started like really saying, no, we should do some bindings, we should do some curses, is I don't know if you ever watched that show, Sherlock, the BBC one. There was a big bad guy who is strangely topical, who just finds a way to abuse everybody around him. And you know, the finale is he's standing there with Watson and he's flicking Watson in the eye again and again and again and again. And you know, the man embodies a threat. He's going to do something terrible if Watson objects to it. And Sherlock does the one thing that is reasonable in that situation, which is to lash out physically at the man to stop him, because nothing but hitting him back is going to stop him. When you are in a situation where you have been ground down, pushed, harmed, where you are getting your eyeball flicked over and over and over again, rolling over and being polite is not the answer. Sometimes you do have to hit back. So for me, that's the criteria. Has someone done something to me or to someone I care about that should be answered, not with so much decorum and politeness that I just author a sternly worded letter to ask them to stop, because there are some people who simply will not.
So I think it's really important to stress that magic is ultimately a very personal and creative act. And there are patterns of how it's expressed, which should be studied and followed, for instance. But the manner these expressions are executed is ultimately unique to each of us. And it's an art. It's incredibly idiosyncratic. So if someone is interested in creating legitimate spells by themselves, or that's even a, maybe I've worded that wrong, saying something is a legitimate spell, I think is actually something I should have considered. But what pointers or recommendations do you have for somebody who wants to, like you have done, craft their own unique spells?
What speaks to you is the first thing to answer Because if it doesn't resonate with you, if it doesn't grab you, if it doesn't get that imaginative spark, the fire of Prometheus burning in your mind, then it's not for you. It's not going to do what you need it to do, which is to harness your power and your energy and hone it like a laser toward whatever your goal is. Which, you know, is why I have a somewhat wishy-washy response to astrology, because it doesn't really resonate with me, and it never really has. I've tried using it, and for me, it doesn't enhance my magic significantly. The few times that I have made accurate use of it, it was because it was important to the person I was doing the work for. And I think there's a lesson there, is magic is a creative endeavor. It is art. It is poetry. It is dance. And it is an expression that is so incredibly personal that you cannot put it into words, really. You have to feel it. You have to experience it. And you will know it when you touch it. You will know it when it lives in you. And I strongly recommend read widely, experiment liberally, but allow yourself the trust and freedom to do what ignites you.
Good, good. So what books do you have to recommend our audience for people who might be interested in learning more about this subject?
Especially if we want to go digging deep into the roots of the Greek and Roman magical papyri and all of the other stuff. Hans-Dieter Betts, of course, the Greek magical papyri in translation. Budge's translation of the Leyden Papyrus, which, just be aware, it's in fragments and it is not, this is not light reading. None of this stuff is light reading. I have got a fantastic translation of the Maklu texts. Oh, let me pull it out here. This is from, okay, this is pricey. It's from the State Archives of Assyria Cuneiform Texts. It's volume 11. And it is the most recent translation of the Maklu texts, which are the burning texts. So this is pre-Greek and Roman. This is Sumerian, Babylonian, but you can see a direct line of Western magic, effigy magic, waxen figures, bindings, nailing things down, naming something and effectively baptizing it in order to bind the figure, the person that you're trying to do, and also the litany of gods and powers and summoning the spirits of night and just hoping that one of them will actually answer your call. The same series has the evil demons, which is incantations of the Ituku. So there's so many things. Curse tablets and binding spells from the ancient world by John Gager is another really good one. And if you want to kind of like start to elide into medieval and Renaissance era European magic, Richard Kiekheffer's Forbidden Rites, which is a translation of a 14th century, I think, Necromancer's Grimoire, 15th, which in its introduction has the very telling bit where in, I remember his name, and I think it was in the 1500s, Niccolo Consigli of Florence was fined for practicing necromancy without a license, which tidbits like that tell us that there was some ability and some situation in which you could legally practice necromancy and that you could get a license to do so. So like those little bits tell us like there's so much more to the story than just some robed fellow mumbling over a strange censer of round scarabs and crocodile dung, trying to hope Beatrice will show up disrobed for him.
Excellent. Thank you so much for those book recommendations. I will, as always, I will include them in the description below and continue to bankrupt myself.
I am at a position in my life where I can purchase these, but some of them are very expensive. Magic and ritual in the ancient world, like a lot of the stuff at this point we're at the point where academic texts and translations of these exist. Like back when I was doing this stuff, it was impossible to find them. They are still well out of most people's price range, but you can probably find someone like me who has them and has a lending library of like 5,000 books, where part of my resistance is actually archiving information that might otherwise be destroyed.
Finally, are you working on anything else at the moment? Or do you have anything that you're especially obsessed with that you would like to share with our audience?
A lot of my work recently has been playing in the intersection between ritual and game, ritual role play and game. So I have a whole little cottage industry of role playing games, mostly solo journaling games, which are also meditations and rituals and magic, and find a weird space in between that. And that is Dark Heart games on itch.io. My other thing is I've got my first book from Crossed Crow Books is coming out in the fall, and that is again another interactive thing. It's a past life journal, so it's a bunch of journaling prompts because reincarnation is a significant part of my own personal practice, but I have a very strong reaction to people who claim to be able to read your past lives for you, because much like magic, I think that's an incredibly personal journey. So this is written so that people can just do that on their own time and on their own terms and determine exactly like how far they want to get immersed. And the only bits that I do is I bookend it with some context, and why it might be helpful, and also pitfalls to avoid, because there are definitely ones that you can get kind of caught up in.
All right, well, thank you so much for sharing all of this truly incredible information and really going deep into this the sense of, I think, the current state of the world as it exists right now, and how we can utilize magic to help ourselves, help our communities. Thank you for coming onto the show and sharing everything with me. It's been really, really wonderful.
This has been a lovely conversation, and I think you said it best. Why not both? Do magic, do physical things, change the world.
That was Michelle Belenga, author of The Little Book of Wicked Spells, Binding and Retribution Magic, a wonderful pamphlet of historically informed modern curses, bindings, and rites of justice, which is part of Hadean's Guides to the Underworld series. I was really fascinated to discuss this maligned subject with Michelle, most particularly because I think it's important to understand that while, yes, there will always be bad actors, manipulators, and those riddled with petty jealousy and bitterness, there will also always be those who are simply bereft of recourse and, having been terrorized, oppressed, and threatened, seek the only means left to them. I especially enjoyed the way Michelle describes this form of her magic as being the marriage of language, song, and rage. I think more than anything, her rage comes from a genuine love of her friends, family, and community. And it's that form of curse or binding, cast from the desire to aid those who have been oppressed, to uplift the downtrodden, to silence the slanderer, and topple the tyrant, where I hope that we can all agree that this form of magic isn't morally grey, but often an absolute necessity. More than anything, I appreciate Michelle's clear and impassioned love for her community, as well as her declaration that magic is not an excuse to sit on your butt and do nothing, but in finding a balance between catharsis and action. If you have made it this far, then thank you so much. As always, we are so grateful for your continued support. Please like, leave a comment, and share this interview with those that you think will appreciate it. Everything that you do really helps the channel grow, reach more people, and support our global authorship. Thank you all so much, and I will see you all again in the next one.